We have, I think, if I'm reading this correctly, I like to think that I am, that we have about 40 minutes to talk about any questions. If no one has questions, then I have a cool thing to talk about. If not, okay. Yes, sir. Yeah.
In the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking to myself, do you really mean that? Aren't alcohol and wine two different things? Or am I misunderstanding? I wouldn't know I'd want to learn that condition.
Yeah. Well, in Scripture, for in Israel, for them they'd be pretty much, maybe I'm not using my words very responsibly there. But for Israelites, they would have, to them, the kind of alcohol they were most familiar with would have been the fruit of the grape, or the, what do you call it, the juice of the grape, the fermented juice of the grape, yeah. Now, for them, this is a little interesting. In Proverbs, you read about wine and strong drink, not the same thing. Wine is, they just drank that all the time. And in from Old Testament times all to Jesus' day, wine was, they drank it all the time, but they drank it very watered down. Watered down until the alcohol content would have been close to like American beer. So that's what they're drinking like all the time, besides water. Strong drink though, because they just watered it down. They would add like up to like two parts water all the way up to like 10 parts water. But when the Bible talks about strong drink, which is what it has its strongest like cautions about, strong drink is like the undiluted stuff where you're just like drinking it straight up, like the way you order it at a restaurant. Right? So that's what the strong drink and the wine is a little different. I'm not sure how it's translated in ESV, but something like that. Good question. All right. Yes, ma'am.
Could you unpack a little bit more what you're talking about with kind of like honorable versus dishonorable
jobs? Oh, yeah.
The role of the Christian there.
Yeah.
Just as someone that used to teach in public school, there were obviously things I taught that I didn't agree with.
Yeah.
But I really did feel called to be there as a Christian for the conversations I had with kids and to help them navigate the questions they had outside of class.
And yeah.
And so it's just something I know that now teaching here at this school, it's something we care a lot about, is like equipping our kids to go in the world and be salt and light and not be afraid to take on professions that you wouldn't normally see Christians in for the sake of representing Christ there.
Right.
So just if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, that's a really exciting, really important. At our time, I can think of very few topics that are more important than that. Let's start with, let's see. First of all, I would say a lot of those questions about wisdom in our occupation are best discussed with other Christians in the same occupation, I think, right? I don't know. This is, I think, a way that churches could serve one another and churches could serve their members a lot is by trying to put together people that are in the same profession and let them talk about this. I remember this, Tim Keller, I don't remember where I heard him talk about this, but he was reading old notes from like the Presbyterian church from like the 1800s. And he was astonished to find that a certain Presbyterian church here in America exercised church discipline of a member because in his business he was selling a product and making like 5% of a profit on it. They thought that was excessive, so they put him under church discipline for that. But his point is not to say that's what we should do today. His point was it's complex, and these are questions that are best talked about with teachers. Like, obviously, you being in the public school system would be a tremendous, I have other friends who made the same choice, kind of held their nose and about certain stuff they didn't like and thought it was worth
the mission field.
Yeah, it's worth the mission field. I would urge caution. I don't know the circumstances that led to you ultimately leaving, but I'm sure as you discover, it's a very, very difficult thing. There's different levels of, there's things that as Christians that we would say, like, as a Christian, I lean away from that, but it's not a moral issue. For Christians, though, I think we have to be very cautious about the environment that we're helping to create, you know, which is why I love to see a church that believes in Christian education. Really love that, because we got to stop kidding ourselves more and more. Like, when I was growing up, like, we didn't want the kids to go to public school because it was just going to be like evolution all day long, and it was going to be like what was it going to be, evolution and a sex ed. Those are the two things today, right? that does not easily compare to what's going on in school systems around, unfortunately. So the situation has evolved quite a bit. I don't know the perfect answer to that, or even the I don't know the best answer to that question. But I do think it's important that we don't kid ourselves. I'll also say this, in American evangelicalism, we have what I have taken to calling missiolatry, an idolization of the mission. Mission is so important that it's worth, for example, throwing Christians under the bus. Like there's certain guys who, there's a fairly well-known preacher from the South here in America, and on Sunday, one of these recent Sundays, he preached a message, and he basically spent the whole message throwing Christians under the bus and saying, like, Christians have gotten this wrong, and Christians have gotten this wrong. Christians have treated these people wrong. Christians treated those people wrong. Who's he talking to? An auditorium full of Christians. But he's doing that. He's throwing Christians under the bus, hoping that some unbeliever in the audience is going to be like, oh, this guy gets me. He's hoping to win over the heart of this one unbeliever. And that is dishonorable. That's dishonorable. Our loyalty should first of all be to the cause of Christ. And so when you're getting it, maybe we could call it the mission's end game, which is to say, like, it is very possible. I would say a society, we could imagine a potential society. I don't think we're there yet as Americans. But you could imagine a potential society where faithful Christians would have literally no platform for outreach, where the choice would be a chance to maybe, you know, build relationships and be a witness or be faithful to Christ. Obviously, if it comes right down to that, we have to choose to be faithful to Christ. So I think as teachers, you had to take it on a case-by-case basis. I would say something very similar if you're in the military. Yeah. Guys, you know, if you want to serve in the American military today, it is very likely that our American military will send you to do some wild stuff. Okay? And so I'm just going to say, like, people ask counsel for that. They're considering enlisting. I'm like, that's fine. But you have to wake up every day and say, today I could be court-martialed. Today I could be dishonorably discharged. Like, I'm prepared for that. I think the same thing, like, not just teacher, any job. I don't care what job you're working at. You got to go in every day saying, if it's today, then it's today. And that's it. I don't have to work here another day. Where we get in trouble is where we're like, no, I have to keep this going. Whether out of some misguided sense of like, no, this is my ministry. Well, it may be your ministry, but it's not going to be much of a ministry if we prove unfaithful to Christ, which there's pockets in our country. My in-laws live in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and I have very good friends there who are part of the school system, and all of their coworkers are members of Baptist churches. Like, they don't like there's essentially none of that pressure that we're seeing yet. But I think it's probably a matter of time. And I think it's important we don't try to take those principles that are currently working in Bowling Green and assume that they're going to work in Gaithersburg. It's like, that's not probably what's going on. Our country is way more diverse than that right now, where we have pockets of incredible anti-Christian sentiment, and we have other pockets where it's like everybody's dad is still a pastor and, you know, uncle's a deacon, and it's like they can get away with it's unbelievable, right? But I've seen those Christians in Bowling Green, I'll be honest. I've seen those Christians in Bowling Green a little self-righteous in their talk about, like, well, I think we should be salt and light in the schools. I think our kids should be in the public school. I'm like, that's easy for you to say in this school district. Yeah. You know? Right. You don't imagine what kids are hearing in certain other school districts in this country. So yeah, exercise some patience and grace with each other. But also, we want that same thing about the smoking or the pornography usage creating an atmosphere. We also want to be very, very cautious that our actions are not empowering and creating and enabling a very evil system to perpetuate. I'm less.
Sure. Yeah, no, I got you.
It's going around.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, please.
Follow-up
yeah.
Question. Just the you spoke a lot about jobs. Mm.
Yeah.
Explaining that to jobs.
Yeah.
Can you unpack a little bit more about the difference between just hard work for the stay-at-home mom?
Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah.
For someone that's not necessarily in a career.
Yeah.
Thinking more about sloth as a, like what you're saying, a worldview.
Yeah, yeah.
Engaging in the hard work around you, whether that works relational or corporate.
Well, I think you just did it. I mean, I think that's a really important, I think that's an important connection to make. Right, absolutely, that we don't want to associate our hard work. Or, for example, if you find some way to hustle, and there's a lot of Christians out there who are because of their concern about the general tenor of the world or our society right now, and they're trying to find alternate ways to make a living or income. I think that some of the same things apply there. But yeah, it's about whether or not we view our work as good and as building and building God's kingdom one way or the other. Yeah, that's an excellent point. I appreciate you making that. Anybody else? I promise I got something cool from Luke 14. If you don't, but give you one more chance here. Josh.
I have one. I'm going to try and explain it the best way I can.
Oh, please do.
It's concerning what you said earlier about gossip.
Okay, yeah.
I'll start with this. So just as an example, so I have a group of friends where we do our best to, like, if we're talking about maybe somebody in a negative light or something that was done, we do our best to try to, like, not name names.
Right.
Are there times where you may not necessarily be either of those things, but it could still be awesome? I don't know
about that. My biggest concern in that part was to liberate your conscience a little bit from the thing where it's like, because people will get mad and call you a gossip if you talked about them when they weren't in the room.
Yeah.
To them, gossip, the definition of gossip is you said something about me that I don't like that you said that. Like that's, but that does not gossip make. Like that's like, you know. So that was my biggest concern. There may be other forms I'm not thinking of. Those two, as I studied Proverbs, those were the two that kept coming to light over and over again: betraying confidences and speaking slanderously. As far there's certainly other kinds of speech that are criticized in Proverbs, like
Oh yeah.
Bury it. Right. Incorporate it into your testimony every time. Yeah, it's like, yeah. That's going in my biography. Thank you. I forgive you, but it's going to be a chapter in my biography. Yeah.
I think sometimes in church culture, there can be something that happens with like a church that's like very well known, or a group of churches that's very well known.
Yeah.
It's very easy to cross the line from like critiquing to like assuming motives.
Right.
The whole story.
Yeah.
And so navigating that as well, I know that's like super cool.
Yeah. We certainly live in a, One of our foolishness, you know, again, according to the book of Proverbs, one of our foolishnesses as a modern culture is our, you know, Phil points out the repeating the matter, a complete lack of forgiveness. There is no concept of absolution or forgiveness or even repentance or even like it's just like everything's a permanent mark on everybody's record. I think we should definitely, I'm trying to think of any specific proverbs that would deal with that. Nothing's coming to mind right off the top of my head. I mean, I would look through those proverbs on speech there at the end. I think that would probably try to like trigger some thoughts there and get you thinking along those lines. But, I don't have anything. Yep. On that. Anybody else? Mm-hmm.
Would qualify as a, you would not argue that China was a society marked by this?
No, yeah.
And so, and you talked a little bit about how being skeptical of the world as you go out.
Yeah.
What does it look like to be intentional in terms of evangelism? You set a boundary on one side of saying, like, yes, we do need to have a category of there's times where we can't idolize the mission so much that we're not faithful.
Right.
possible to be so afraid, so skeptical of the culture that we
give up on
miss opportunities?
Yeah. Yes, definitely. I would say I'm sure there is. That's a characteristic of Christians in the New Testament, certainly in the book of Acts, which is the one book I would feel much more comfortable doing a series of talks on than the book of Proverbs would be the book of Acts. But the Christians are certainly marked by a freedom of speech, by great freedom. The word that's translated boldness in our Bibles, where it's describing how the Christians in the early years of the church were marked by boldness. That word boldness has the idea of being unrestrained and open, an openness to it. So in other words, if you're always holding back and you can't say that, that's what it means to not be bold. The boldness is just like, it just like comes to mind and you just say it. So I would say any time where we as Christians are intentionally holding our tongue to not offend the worldlings, which my friend the other day said, why are you saying worldlings all the time? Where did you hear this? Where I was like, I read in a Puritan book and I loved it. It's like my favorite thing. Puritans were always calling the worldlings. I was like, this is great, you know? It's like, always, okay. So that's kind of the, that's one thing I say. It's like, we're always holding our tongue. We're always, that's a sign we're not characterized by that freedom of boldness that we see in the, but yeah, I'm not sure that, skepticism about the world. I want to talk a little bit more about that that missiolatry or that idolization of the mission. We don't like this, and again, you guys may land a different place about this. I'll just tell you what the conclusion of my study is like a lot of Christians, we feel really bad that we're not better witnesses than we are. And we can really beat ourselves up, like, how have I been a Christian for this length of time and I haven't seen anybody come to Christ, I haven't brought anybody to church, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But we have to be very careful that we don't equate the situation that we're living in right now and our time and place with the situation in the first century. It's radically different. Like, please don't compare yourself, whether you're a missionary or whatever you are, don't compare yourself to the Apostle Paul or to Peter and say, well, if there's some, we have a tendency to do this though, right? Where we assume everything's normative. Like, well, Peter preached, like if I had a dollar for every time I heard a preacher say something like, listen, Peter preached a sermon on Pentecost and 3,000 people were converted. What's wrong with us? Like, what does a Peter preaching on Pentecost have to do with us preaching here today? It doesn't compare, like it just, on the surface level, it sounds compelling. It's like not actually a viable thing. It's like the scripture does not even pretend that that was a normal thing. You wanna know how many times that happened in scripture? 1.0 times, like it happened exactly one time. So it's like, it's not pretending like this is the normal thing for the way church is supposed to happen, right? So we want to be careful that we don't, we want to eagerly seek opportunities. But isn't this fast? I would say it like this. The New Testament, witnessing is really seen as much more about God's initiative than we tend to feel. We tend to believe like, if I'm not witnessing more often, it's because I'm not taking enough initiative and that it's all on me. But really, according to scripture, like for example, you look at the book of Acts. Look at the book of Acts, like you see how many evangelistic occasions were orchestrated by the Holy Spirit. It's like that Christians were thrust into a spotlight all of a sudden and a microphone was put in front of them. It was like, talk, Christian. And they had to do it. So as a Christian, you should be spending most of your thought about evangelism in getting yourself ready for that moment and praying that God brings those moments so that when it happens, you're not like, I don't know what to say. Like you want to be so full and so ready and prayed up so much that when that moment comes, and let me tell you, that's where almost, I'll just be honest, this is where almost all evangelistic fruit in a church is going to come from. Almost all. There'll be some by God's grace. He will reward our other efforts that we do, but generally, almost all evangelistic programs and efforts of churches around the country have a net output of zero, or very close to zero. Like nothing works. I'm speaking as a missionary. You want to know what works? Nothing. Nothing works. And yet somehow the church still grows and the Lord adds to the church daily around the world. He does that. But he does that in ways that we wouldn't have expected. The most important thing is that like, you're bold. There's not all these walls to communication so that when the light gets turned to you, the microphone gets stuck in front of you, they say, hey, will you teach this lesson? at school, you're going to teach this lesson next week, and you say, no, I'm not. You know, that's the moment. That's the moment. We don't recognize it sometimes when it comes, but that's what it is. It's when your boss tells you, we're going to be doing a deal with this company, you're saying, no, I'm not. Right? That's when it's really going to, or your neighbor wants your neighbor kid wants your kid to go participate in something, and you're like, no, you're not. Like that, those are the moments of witness that we don't maybe recognize as what they are. Okay. That's a little distance from Proverbs, I think, Sarah. How many kids does it take to be powerful? Who's the guy that says, try to have one more than you think you can handle? It's either him or me. Probably him. Yeah, right. We know it's him. He adds a zero after the one. Yeah. But what I mean by that is whether I mean it or whether Kevin means it, what we mean is that's an area to exercise faith. So let me tell you one of the ways that we should we don't exercise faith just in our own ambition or our own creative our own brainstorming, right? That's good. Sometimes God gives people the gift of faith and they can do things like that. But where faith is really required is like this. God says, this is good. This is good for you to have. And you're like, but I don't know though. I don't know if that's really what I want. And so pushing yourself in that direction, that's a step of faith, right? There's many people, it's like they're like, I don't think I want to have kids. I would say a step of faith for you is like have a kid. Like just add one. Start there, you know. Or you've got four kids, and you're like, I think, you know, if we had any more that it might, you know, we might not be able to have our life just the way we want. It's like, well, maybe one more. I don't know. That would be my guess. It's easy for me to say. I have two. We would have liked to have had more. We're very blessed that God gave us two, but we would have liked to have been more powerful. I was reading about, I'm reading a biography of G.K. Chesterton right now, and him and his wife got married, and they both wanted to have like seven kids, and it just was not what God had planned for them, and they were totally unable to conceive. But I think one of the things that Proverbs does for us, we get so nuanced to death. So many truths in the church today die the death of 1,000 nuances. Okay, so let me tell you, don't want to hurt your feelings. Many of you are singles, right? So we're all bending over backwards to tell the single people that it's okay to be single. Some of y'all, that is not the message you need to hear. The message you need to hear is like, you should probably be looking for opportunities to get married, right? You need to truly believe that being married is a good thing, right? Is it good to be single? Sure. It's good to be single and belong to the Lord. In the same way, it's good to be like, I don't know, in a wheelchair and belong to the Lord, right? It's good. It's good. It's good to be a slave and belong to the Lord. 1 Corinthians 7. Slave is the Lord's free man. Okay? It's good. But probably something better, right? Sorry. So a lot of what Proverbs is doing is like giving us that a gauge, or it's giving us a readout. What do you call it? Again, it's that control panel that's giving us a readout, telling us what's good, what's bad, right? So we're always trying to be so careful to nuance things that we're missing out on some really, really obvious truths. Like, yeah.
I got a question. Just on that topic you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. It's like in Genesis, you know, God gives Adam Eve, and he says, this is good.
Mm.
And in one of Paul's letters, it's better to be single.
Yeah.
And so there's like these two, like, with just Adam, God was like, man is lonely, let me create him a wife. And we obviously see the truths of man.
Yeah.
That's just self-explanatory.
Yeah.
But like Paul's like, hey, he's like trying to convince people to be single almost, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
So like, what's with the
Yeah. I would say this would take us pretty far afield, so I won't get into this. I would just say, suffice it to say, I think that is a very common and very unfortunate misrepresentation of what Paul's getting at in 1 Corinthians 7. There's certain phrases that Paul says that look just like that. Like it would be, that would give us the idea that it would be better to be single, that you should almost feel like a loser as a Christian if you couldn't hack it as a single person and you have to go to the courthouse and get married. Like, that's not what Paul is getting at. What Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7 is everybody's got their own gift. Paul acknowledges that his gift is a very unusual one. It's in the serious minority. And what we also have, what Paul says in the very first verse of that chapter, he says, first two verses, he says, it's better to marry than to burn. He says, because of the present evil, it's good for every man to have their own wife. In other words, he says, it's good to be married rather than to burn with lust. And so whenever I have somebody tell me, like, I think I have the gift of the Apostle Paul, I say, well, do you burn with lust? You know, so the one of the problems is, like, we don't, here's a truth. Here's a nuance that we can nuance ourselves to death with. Does marriage cure one of sexual lust? No, it does not. If you are in the habit of capitulating to sexual lust before you're married, it's only a matter of time after you're married that you'll go back. Because like we said earlier about lust, it's by its nature, it's violative. It's by its very nature, it wants to violate a boundary. So if you're in the habit of violating boundaries, you will continue to do that after you're married. Okay, so we say things like that, like marriage is not going to solve your lust problem, right? It's like, yes, but that is also not really the thing to say most of the time when you're considering whether or not you're a person who needs to get married. If you are a Christian who is striving to say no to lust at every turn, you're not the person who's habitually capitulating to lust. You're the person who's striving to say no to lust. Then you should look at marriage as a very helpful and wonderful thing that will help you in the battle that you've already decided to fight. You know what I'm saying? Like, you see how close those, like, they sound close, but they're not close at all. It's a totally different attitude. All right, anybody else?
I've got one, but if you don't want to get nuancey.
Oh, I love love nuance.
You just said this is just a small thing.
Yeah,
Yeah. A lot of people and a lot of preachers especially, I've noticed, like to use woke as a category.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I would just love to hear what your definition,
working
definition of woke is, because it means something different.
Sure.
No matter what side of that situation
Yeah.
Into a woke category, would
hate
the way woke people are described.
Yeah.
So just for the sake of not othering a whole group of people,
I appreciate you giving me that. So I largely chose these three labels as a joke.
Yes.
So it does. Thank you very much. Yeah, we could have done that. I could have chosen that, and that would have made everything a lot simpler. So this has almost no resemblance to the discussion of the woke ideology conversation today. I chose it because I saw there was a meme for a while on Twitter that was being passed around where people were joking. Any opinion in the world, they're breaking it down into the broke, woke, and bespoke ideas of it, where it's like, but that, and that's where it comes from. So they would always say the broke idea is the one that like the total, like, you know, like that the fools who haven't thought about this situation at all, that's what they think. But the woke is, they've been schooled, they've learned, their eyes are open. They think they see it. They've transcended what. So they're always looking down at all the normals who believe all their, you know, stupid things, like bunch of sheep, you know, the sheep and all the lies that they believe. And I see my eyes are open now, and I see the truth. That's the only comparison it has with the woke ideology. The word woke is being used. But then the joke going on to say bespoke. You know, bespoke is like the most expensive version of a product that you can buy. It's like the fanciest level of something. So it's saying like, oh, no, you can be double woke. You can learn even more. You can find out that even the woke people, they're not seeing the whole thing. So what's better than woke? It's even better to be bespoke. So that's the only reason I chose those things, but okay. I should have known better. Why didn't I just say A, B, and C? That would have been a lot there, much less controversial. Anybody else? Okay, time for one more. Make it a good one.
Just
I would love to, that would be a lot of fun. I would love to, I'll go anywhere, anytime to talk about the Book of Acts. That's my favorite book. Let me tell you the way I, just this week actually, as I was thinking about Proverbs, the final, we'll wrap everything up with this. I found a scriptural confirmation of this sort of, that we should be digging in Proverbs down to, again, bespoke, we want to be thinking underlying worldview. If you look at Proverbs, well, let's not do this. Who remembers Jesus tells a parable once? It's kind of like a parable, but he says, if you're invited to a feast, where should you sit? In the best seat? No. Sit where? Sit in the back. Sit in the crappy seat, right? Sit in the nosebleeds. Why? He says, then someone's going to come and be like, what are you doing here? Come up here and you'll be on. Now, a lot of people have been struck by that little parable of Jesus. They've thought like, what, is this serious? Is Jesus seriously like just giving a lesson on party etiquette? Like that seems like for the Son of God to be here in his earthly ministry, that would seem like not a very important thing. But if you really dig into the context of what's going on there in Luke 14, it's very clear that Jesus is advocating a posture of the heart. A person who in their heart says, where do I belong? I do not belong in the chief seat. I belong in the back. I have no business being here. Like when you're at church, what's your attitude? You'd be like, I have no business being here as part of the people of God. And he says that is, then Jesus goes on to say, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. It's the fundamental mindset of a Christian. Now, I just totally overlooked this. I didn't even realize this, but look at Proverbs chapter 25, just to end here. Proverbs 25. Proverbs 25, verse 6. Do not put yourself forward in the king's presence or stand in the place of the great, for it is better to be told, come up here, than to be put lower in the presence of a noble. Where did Jesus get that teaching from? He got it from the book of Proverbs. Now, again, if you came to this with a broke perspective, you'd say, okay, when I'm in the king's presence or in the place of the great, I should not try to put myself forward. I should take a lower position because it's better to be told, come up here. Okay? Jesus didn't interpret that just as a rule. He turns that into an entire paradigm for what your heart should be like before God. So he read this thing that looks like a very practical instruction for how to behave in front of a king. And Jesus dug down to the underlying worldview and said, this is what your heart should be like before God. So just a little incidental confirmation that digging down to that underlying worldview is exactly what we should be doing in the book of Proverbs. All right, thanks, guys.